live from Sydney, Australia. Welcome to the Guilty Remnant podcast. I'm Renee, and with me I've got Craig.
Hello, Renee.
Hang on. What?
What? That's you.
That is me. It's in physical and real life for a change, and this time without a cold.
And not sick.
But I've got a few days. My son is sick, so surely it would happen in a few days' time.
That's it. Now I'm here, I'm going to be sick too. So
yay, sharing the love.
Sharing is caring.
Now, when you think about the most recent Guilty Remnant, The Leftovers TV show episode, Craig?
I don't know. I haven't seen that TV show.
What? Are we podcasting about it?
Oh, is that what this is?
No. So in fairness, I'm just excited that The Leftovers is back on TV. It's my favourite TV show. It's in its last series, unfortunately. I want to cry because of it. And you know what makes me more sad is that almost everyone in Australia actually doesn't know what the TV show is about. So
there you go. I've been watching Mad Men since I was held up in bed for almost a week and a half. So 5 seasons of Mad Men later. All I can really think about is 1960s advertising.
Cool. Well, maybe not talking about The Leftovers or Guilty Remnant or Mad Men. Maybe we should talk about agile stuff.
Get out of here.
I know. Crazy.
I thought you wanted to call this the Leftovers Revolution.
I wouldn't mind it, but anyway.
Actually, as an aside, just a real aside, I have noticed more and more that there's these really awesome podcasts now that when you are getting hooked on a television
TV show,
yeah, where they talk about the episodes. And I'm working my way back through The West Wing, which is the most awesome television show ever, and enjoying it
even more.
Yeah, 15 years
in
later.
In memory. What I like about them as well is that they give you a level of insight that you probably don't necessarily think of as you go through the episode, and so you sort of you pick up all these new things as a result of it. And maybe people pick up new things in Agile as we talk through the podcast.
I'm like this podcast where you learn absolutely nothing. What is going on in the world of agility?
There's been an awful lot of interesting stuff in the news lately in Australia. So probably the biggest newsworthy item has been the announcement from ANZ in the last few weeks, and this will be a long time by the time this is published, but in essence, an article that ANZ have decided to go effectively what I'd call whole hog into Agile.
Diving in.
First. Everything other than branches going into the Agile sphere of influence. Now, I can see that you've pulled up an article on it. Did you want to sort of brief us a bit more about what's in the newsworthy article? And just to highlight for people who aren't from Australia, ANZ is one of the four top leading banks in Australia.
And also across New Zealand, Friends of New Zealand.
That would be the NZ part of ANZ, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, they own other banks there as well. And across Southeast Asia, at least, in parts. So basically the CEO has come out just recently and said that he wants to shake everything up and bring in a new management style. And the reasons for doing that is that he wants to make sure that the way they respond to customers or users is improved. He wants to empower staff, and he wants to improve productivity. And so guess what? He's going down the scaled agile path.
Does he say scaled agile?
He says, in quotes, "The bank will adopt a scaled agile philosophy, a proven approach which originated in the tech industry, and they'll roll it out."
Well, interesting. It's philosophy. You didn't say approach.
Yes, so he doesn't mean scale agile framework necessarily. There.
No, he means to scale at people, right?
At least that's
which
what
is,
I draw on there.
Which is the old school interpretation of scaled agile, yeah.
And I think the interesting thing about this mostly, and so we were talking about this offline the other week, is that I quite often, when I'm teaching classes or introducing people who are sort of first on their journey, I'll pick everyday companies and I'll say, "What do you think? Do you think they're agile? Do you think they're they're not so agile?" And ANZ for many years has been one of those organisations that would not be top of mind. In the banking sector, there are other banks in this country that people would pick. People will pick Google, for example, as being an agile company, or Amazon. But they're not necessarily going to pick a more traditional thing like the postal company or something like that. The interesting thing is that ANZ always would come out as someone going, "Hey, doesn't really seem agile to me." And I think, from also, being around the outskirts of that organisation, knowing people there, that's probably It's got some truth to it. They have been doing agility there for a few years. To exactly what extent is hard to tell. I mean, I think somewhere in here they mention, 20% of their projects, or 20% of their technology and digital projects are currently using agility. But I think it was just recently when they became the first bank in this country to introduce Apple Pay, which has been we're an agile podcast, not a general technology podcast, but there's been a lot of resistance to banks in this country going down the Apple Pay path, for example. They went and did that. They did that in 10 weeks. It was an example of an experiment. The experiment worked. It actually attracted a lot of new business because it was something that people were crying out from other banks, and it's actually given them a lot of upshift. And I think as a result of that, they've seen exactly what this thing can do. And so it's an example of when you can do good projects and deliver good things, this can happen. The difference with that is, though, that it's a small project. It's a small 10-week, small exercise. Get the thing out there, design thinking, deliver. Are they going to try and, is the first person going to pull off the bank? It's like, oh, let's go and upgrade our core banking system, or, let's update our financial system.
And they do acknowledge that core banking as a product is going to be a challenge for them on part of that journey. So I think they're not going into that naively in that respect. But I do somewhat agree that when I heard the 10 weeks, it wasn't out of the ballpark as far as I'm concerned. Certainly other banks have implemented things like the ability to use your Apple Watch, have a banking product inside of that in the space of 5 weeks. So that's quite crazy.
I'm not suggesting 10 weeks is too long. What I'm suggesting is that they've had a win on something that is rather
small. Without a doubt. And I'm just acknowledging that others with Agile have also had significant wins. But what happened probably in that case, I would say, was all constraints were off the table. You can just imagine how that played out in that, we need to get this out quick, what can we do? Everything just went off the table, and so they just worked effectively without process. Hmm. Well, anyone could do that.
But look what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas when you come in and go, all right, everyone's got to be doing Agile, everyone's got to stand up at 9 o'clock in the morning, everyone's got to produce their reports at the end of the sprint so that, we can see the reporting, then that's not like their 10-week Apple Pay project. Yeah, that's, in the words of Silicon Valley, another great show, right, this just became a job.
Yeah. Look, I think there's some interesting statements in there about what they're going to do from a management perspective. They're planning on cutting huge swaths of people outside of the hierarchy. Groups, I don't know, layers of people. To the extent of, like I saw in one area, it was almost like they wanted to go down to something like 5 levels. Now, I think a lot of people cynically have looked at that and said, okay, they're just doing this to get rid of people.
Yeah, cost-cutting, yay,
cost-cutting. For the win. And rather than make it look bad in the press, they've said we're doing it for the purposes of Agile.
It's always going to get that connotation, though, and that's the unfortunate thing. I know a few large organisations, won't name names, but where the people on the ground are trying to do really good things, but when it comes to the crunch, because it is associated with, as they come in and improve things, and as it's associated with them, finding things that don't make a lot of sense, it regardless of what good they're doing, it gets seen as a cost-cutting exercise or a getting rid of people exercise.
Yeah, I mean, whilst it certainly could be cynically seen that way, I sort of looked at it and thought, well, is it a bad thing to potentially, in an agile transformation, to be getting rid of unnecessary tiers of management?
As long as people don't, as long as that doesn't become agile.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if the only thing you see from the outside is just that your buddy's just been laid off.
Yeah.
And your department hasn't been agiled yet.
Yeah.
And I'm doing air quotes as I say this, by the way, people.
Yeah.
Then of course people are going to be really resistant.
I think that's a good point. It's sort of like a bastardization of the term more than anything else. What I did notice coming out a few days afterwards were some interesting quotes, sort of following up on that. There was some quotes around an acknowledgement that it all comes down to execution, that it's all great to make these statements, but they acknowledge that there's a huge amount of work for them going forward. They do talk about things like wanting to move towards things like self-directed teams. That's a huge step. That's probably a step I'd say most organisations aren't yet willing to take. And if they do pull it off, that would be a big deal. They're talking about speed to market, radical overhauls. And it was, there was also talking about decommissioning. So they acknowledged that their structure of their systems was quite complex and that they wanted to remove at least 44 applications to reduce risk and complexity. So, you know, they're saying a lot of great things, acknowledging the immensity of the problem that is going to be ahead of them.
And I think the thing that's probably the most heartening for me is that the messaging is coming from the CEO.
Yeah, I agree.
Most of these things you see coming from the CTO or the CIO, whereas this is a whole of organisational approach. And I really hope they're successful at it. They're a reasonably sized organisation. They're not the biggest financial institution. They're not the smallest. Out of the large banking and financial organisations in this area of the world, they're probably the one that's got the most chance to do it if they do it right.
Yeah, good luck to them.
Yeah, absolutely. This is completely opposite to something that came out just recently. This is one of these surveys that goes around the place, but recent reports coming out that the UK is wasting £37 billion a year on failed IT projects.
Seen this failed one? Agile.
IT projects, yes. The company that did this, a company called 6.6, never heard of them before, so can't validate them, but they surveyed 300 CIOs in the UK and the US to examine the experiences of Agile and measure how successfully the principles are being applied. And the findings came out and said that 12% of Agile projects are failing completely. The CIOs tell them they expect to undertake 6 Agile projects next year. Just 6 on average, and of which that the average Agile IT project costs approximately £8 million, and that represents a huge amount of waste. And their conclusion is, the truth is, despite the hype over the theory, Agile development doesn't always work in practice.
I'm not sure of the metrics, but I'm curious. Waterfall had a failure rate of what?
Yes,
I thought it was about 30%, wasn't it?
Well, it was depending on which Standish report you quote, but somewhere in the 20% was the complete failures, and around the 60-70%, depending on which year you wrote, of failed, which is either over cost or over time or both.
Right. So, I'm sorry, I'm confused.
So 12% is rather good if you actually take that number.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you compared it, if that group went down the waterfall path, wouldn't it have been higher?
Yeah, this is one of those reports which...
it's a scaremongering report. Yeah.
But this is the one that really concerns me. So regardless of what you think about that, the research uncovered that 53% of CIOs regard agile development as discredited, while 75% are no longer prepared to defend it. 73% of CIOs think agile IT has now become an industry in its own right, while 50% say they now think of agile as an IT fad. That's a concerning thing for me.
Well, that's perception, right?
Yeah, and my problem is that maybe I'm just getting old and cynical, but that's probably not an unfair assumption because
I agree.
Either within or more importantly past your agile work, how often does it stick and how often does it stay in place? In large organisations, the answer is that it's less than it should be.
And I think there's a fairness in some of the concerns raised by that C-suite as well, is that when consultants go in and they go, well, your last Agile implementation didn't work because you didn't do X, Y, and Z, and usually consultants will say because you didn't go wide enough, you didn't go broad enough. And so in effect, they ask for an even greater investment on top of that. Now, I'd have to admit there's a reality that there's not enough data points of success at an enterprise level whatsoever to say that it's going to make a difference. No one should be saying that from a consulting perspective with their hand on their heart right now. I think there's some good data to show value at the team level, but we all know that the team level is effectively a local optimization, and so you can only go so far as well. What is interesting to me in that is that comparison between failure rates of agile projects versus failure rates of waterfall projects. I mean, no project is ever going to unequivocally succeed. Some things will always fail. Now, you'd hope with Agile that you'd fail faster, you'd spend less money as a result of that, and that's part of the benefits. And it's not a bad thing necessarily that Agile fails, but you want to try and reduce your risk on spend as a result of that. But that difference in percentage, if it's, let's say, 10 or 15%, well, what does that work out to a dollar spend? And what's the comparison of that dollar spend to your investment in going towards Agile? Because if the failure difference cost-wise is less than your transformation cost, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the statement in here that the average Agile IT project costs approximately £8 million.
That's pretty huge.
Well, I'm thinking about it in two lines. My first thing was is that, wow, what are they doing for their, what am I getting for my $8
million? Yeah.
But then I know plenty of transformation projects, and you do too, where that's dropping the bucket, right?
Yeah, I know some companies that spend $1 million a week on a project, yeah.
Yeah, like hundreds of millions of dollars. And so, therefore, if the average IT project only costs $8 million, and only 20% of the failing, actually, maybe we're still ahead, right? Because maybe we're learning.
Yeah.
And that's what this doesn't take into account. It doesn't take into account the learning. My real sense of this, though, is that what you've got is a bunch of, you know, half-assed Agile going on in every one of these ones that are going on, and that's essentially what they're seeing. It's not real true agility. It's half-assed agility.
Yeah, but I do feel that we do, as a community, have a problem with that half-assed comment in that... what is true agility? How do you define what true agility is? I don't know how we fix this problem, but I do acknowledge that we actually do have a problem there.
So to me, the real key in this is the fact that, 53% discredit, 75% no longer prepared to defend it. Now, this is a pretty narrow survey, and, they probably went, for the people who wanted to call the fat, I guess. But regardless of that, though... If they're discrediting it or no longer, what are they prepared to defend? What are they going back to?
What are they staying up for? Yeah.
Like, no, I want to go back to waterfall, please.
Yeah. Well, maybe they had predictability in waterfall. And they had predictability because they were working everyone to the bone.
And maybe that worked in 1983 or 1997. But there you go. Anyway, interesting stuff coming out there. This one caught my eye a little bit because... I at least like to see that, people are, at least challenging things, whether I agree with it or not, and I don't know too much about the data. And there's a whole report there. I'll put a link in the show notes, towards it.
More data is better for us in the long run.
At the end, I don't have the download in front of me. I did download it to my PC, which I have in front of me, but they have, obviously these guys are consultancy, and they have an agenda document to help you tackle the problem and help you survive the post-agile era, as they call it.
Oh, so they give the solution to what you go back to.
Yeah, you have to sign up.
Oh, cool. So there's going to be a new consultancy fad of post-agile.
Apparently, yeah.
I'm intrigued. I guess we'll see over time how that goes.
There you go.
And on other news items, I can't even remember the date. I think this was back in March. There was one interesting...
It'll be okay if this actually doesn't get released for another 10 months.
There was a recent article about IBM's remote working and them calling thousands of employees back to the office.
Oh, yeah, this is the one I brought to your attention, wasn't it?
You did. You did. And I thought it was noteworthy in itself. So
this was the one I was actually looking for before we started the show, thinking there was something else I wanted to bring up. So thank you for bringing this up.
You're welcome.
What a load of bollocks is all I want to say about this.
What? Okay, for a start, the precept on it is that...
Hello to my friends at IBM.
They're talking about, they're referring to the studies of researchers who, if you work in close proximity, you've got more impact, greater communication. There's the water cooler effect where, you get to have that spontaneous conversation and learn. You can have a lot of unplanned meetings in place, lots of interesting relationships to, studies of why co-location is valuable. But why do you say bull?
Because this is... What year is it? I haven't looked. I've been watching a lot of Mad Men. It's not 1967, is it?
It's 2017.
Okay, so 2017. Right?
Yeah.
Where did you work today, Renee?
I worked from home today. But in fairness, most days I do not work from home.
Oh, but you worked from home today and you could, couldn't you?
I could, yes.
Hmm. Has your boss been emailing you to check in that you've actually been doing stuff? And
No, but he asked me a few questions on WhatsApp and I replied.
There you go. So, yeah. I mean, even though you were sitting in your pyjamas.
I was not in my pyjamas. I am now, but no, let's not go into that.
No, let's not go into that. Let's edit that. Yes. Anyway, but someone wasn't checking up on you, right? And so the thing that...
But it's got nothing to do with checking up.
Are you sure?
Well, I don't feel co-location has anything to do with checking up. Do you?
I think there are certain managers out there that like to be able to see what their people are doing.
So you think that the whole reason they're doing it is because they don't trust their staff?
I think there is an element of that. I don't think that's the whole reason, but I suspect there's an element of that. I have spoken to many managers over the years who like to be able to see that their staff are in the office and working.
See, I thought you were going to go down the line of cynical perspective that they were doing this to try and shed more people.
That too.
Oh, right. Okay.
But it is IBM, right?
What does that mean?
Well, have they just announced recently that they're... there's a report coming out every month from IBM that they're shedding another 200 people here, 200 people there.
That was well known 5 or 6 years ago when they actually explained that that was their strategic plan.
Hmm. So here's another way of doing it.
Right, so it's an alternative approach, you feel?
Possibly.
Right.
The thing is that they've built this culture, rightly or wrongly, and I don't work there, I'm only spitting from the side here, but they built this culture in this team for whatever reason where there's people located all over the planet or over the US.
Well, they were one of the earliest advocates for
and so a whole bunch of people in good faith are working in different cities and different all these things, and all of a sudden the organization says essentially what they're saying in there is we're bringing them back to 6 hubs.
Yes.
And if you're not one of these 6 cities, you either move or you leave.
Yeah.
And when they started this, how many years ago it was a lot harder to do that.
Yeah.
They've gone through the tough stuff. The technology is, particularly in the US where, there's internet on every street corner, the technology's there to support this. So why else would you be doing this?
Because you care about the outcomes of people being able to communicate more effectively?
But the reality is, in agility, is that when we started all those years ago, back when we were young and had not so much grey hair and all the rest of it.
For the record, I do not have grey hair, but Craig does.
I do, yes. But let's not go there either. But when we started back, when we were younger, Renee, all those years ago, it was the only way we could do it. Right, so co-location was always a big thing, a really big thing for agility, for the first 5 to 10 years. But technology has gotten so good now that there are lots of people doing this extremely well in a distributed fashion. It's possible to do this distributed.
So you're saying that you would prefer, when you go into an organisation and
what are these people doing? What department is doing this?
I got a feeling it was a huge number, including marketing and a few others. I don't have the full page up on me, but
so in a lot of cases, I suspect these are head office, HR, marketing, finance. That's how I get the impression from that from that report. These are people who are often self. They're not getting as much value as we do in a traditional IT team or product team or delivery team.
Oh, so you're saying they don't have as many handoffs, dependencies, they can work solo and get outcomes.
Yeah, they could have a shared task list and just pull off the next thing. And whilst collaboration is a huge thing, we don't do enough of it in a lot of those central services to help each other out. Bring them all back to home base, I don't think it's going to solve that problem. They're still probably all going to be sitting at their desk or their cubicle, tapping away on their own stuff.
Mm. So to be clear, you are an advocate of teams being co-located together if they're doing complex work that requires heavy communication between them?
Absolutely, but I'm also a realist in the fact that it's 2017 now and people... have lots of needs, and just society in general has lots of needs to have more people working from locations that make sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
To save pollution, to save traffic, to work-life balance, all those type of things. So the reality is that we have to find ways, and as a community, we need to find more ways of helping people make that balance.
Yeah, I certainly think the long-term future is a future whereby everyone's working via a virtual self of them online somehow, in a persona in that format, and you'd still have the effectiveness of the communication. I don't think tools are quite there just yet, according to some of the studies that have reproduced the Thomas Allen curve, but we've got a bit of way to go.
We're slowly getting better.
Yep.
But the reality is pulling everybody back to home base is not the solution to this problem. What I would like to see from a company like IBM is that being someone who sells tools, make the stuff better. Right? Make me want to go and buy an IBM tool to support this. That's what I'd love to see.
I don't believe it's in their strategic pathway right now, Greg.
Possibly not.
No.
I've used their Agile tool.
Okay, what else do you have for us?
This one's a bit of a fun one. This is the 17 essential hacks that every Scrum Master should know.
Cool.
So do you know these, Renee?
I might know some of them. I haven't read the blog post.
There you go. This is a yep. Okay, so okay. Let me hide all the right. Load report from you. Okay, so number one, is your Scrum board looking untidy due to curling edges on your Post-it notes? Right, I know you know the answer to this. Right, do you know how to peel a Post-it note correctly?
Well, I was taught, in fairness, not the pull method, which is pull directly towards your body very quickly method. I was taught the whole sideways one in one sort of layer. In fairness, I use super sticky 3M Post-it notes because I'm absolutely fed up with those buggers falling off any sort of wall. And especially assuming most companies that I work by, the cheap Staples versions, which don't ever stick to walls.
And the company I work for gets them printed themselves, and only the Staples ones. And they are really bad.
Right. Anyway, I find if you buy 3M super stickies, it's never an issue, no matter which way you pull it off.
Yeah, and so I learned from the same book as you is that most people peel them from the bottom to the top, which is the worst way they curl. I was told to peel from the side.
It's me too, yeah.
I've gone back with the rubbish ones to now pulling them down quickly, and I'm getting better results.
Awesome.
So I don't know whether I was just doing it wrong before or whatever, but yeah, there you go.
Well, see, I think it's the act of when you pull it up from the bottom upwards, as in an upward stroke, it causes the curl as opposed to pulling straight towards your body.
Mm-hmm. And this would have worked a whole lot better if we had a video, because we're just moving our arms around in the fashion of...
La, 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 la.
All right, number two. Do you know how to open a brand new Post-it pack?
Yeah, they come with plastic? Yes, you pinch them together so that the bottom end and the top end sort of rapidly crunches together, and then you sort of twist it as if... I can't actually describe what that was. Anyway, it comes
in. So for those listening, Renee has her, like, a fist, and she's doing it like
quack,
a spider.
Quack, quack,
yeah, it's like in, out, in, out, in, out.
Anyway, it breaks off pretty quick rather than actually doing the whole, let me open the edges thing.
Yeah, you just squeeze the thing together. Yeah. The plastic is designed to break and it opens up, yeah.
Well, 3M's plastics are. I don't know about other organisations.
Yeah. All right. Have you ever gone into a meeting room and seen that some joker has written in a permanent marker instead of a whiteboard marker?
Yes, I have.
What do you do?
I get a whiteboard marker, and then I write on top of the permanent pen with my whiteboard marker. And then probably, because you've actually ruined the whiteboard marker, you throw the whiteboard marker into the bin so that no one else has the problem of that. And then if you're actually going to be really pedantic about it, like I am, you get paper towels, and you get some water onto the paper towel, and then you wipe the board, and that forever makes it beautiful.
But what about that spray stuff that they always have in there?
Don't ever use that spray stuff. It makes it way worse, and I know you were trying to goad me just then.
Yeah, so as it says on here, if you run a whiteboard and permanent pen, then scribble over with a whiteboard pen and rub off, people will think you are a wizard. Do people think you are a wizard when you do that, Renee?
They do, yes. And it's not just that, it's everything I do, naturally.
This next one's actually one I like, and it's one I don't get to use often enough. But quite often I'll use whiteboards, like those wheelie whiteboards.
The ones that you trip over,
the legs on them. But I'll use them as the board because you can move them around, and they work in activity-based working spaces and stuff. So quite often you want to create swim lanes. So if you want to create swim lanes on a piece of whiteboard, you've got the option. You could draw the swim lanes, but sometimes that's a bit messy and cumbersome. And so one of the suggestions I have here is to use magnetic pins and wrap string around the magnetic pins so you can actually move things up and down. And so much better than painter's tape, and probably a little bit neater than just drawing on a pen that can get rubbed off and those kind of things. So I don't think we use magnets enough. I think magnets are awesome, and we should use magnets more. If your team is stuck prioritizing stories, They recommend in this article that if you put them in alphabetical order, they'll soon rearrange them.
Because people say that's not right. This is there. This should be up here.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just a thing.
Okay.
I find if I just put them in some random order and just like, you know, put them all over the place and, you know, make it a little bit messy, people tend to kind of go and fix it.
Yep. Okay.
Does your team struggle to start talking during stand-up?
Nope.
Have you had that problem in the past? Or seen it? You know the answer to this question.
Well, I just have a really clear rule. So I always make my teams go into a semicircle. And you always start left to right for me.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on which. Interesting. It depends on the approach way of people to the board. So I'd make it start on the end where the approach way is facing away from. So that way, a stragglers can come in. They can actually add. That's complexity totally again. But aside from that, just having a really clear standard that everyone knows, you just start right at that point in time. You don't wait for anyone to start on the dot. Always left to right.
And what if they start talking to you as the scrum master or the coach?
Well, there's a few different tricks and tips associated with that. So generally, you'd be trying to be in a position at the line that doesn't enable that to occur. So I find if you have a semicircle, not the halfway point, but a quarter point's really good to stand out. And then
again, you're using your hands and nobody can see them, Renee.
I said halfway, then quarter. Like, I described it and used my hands to work out how I was going to describe it. Thank you. But you look down at your shoes. So is a nice technique of not creating that direct contact, eye contact that can occur.
Yeah, and so what they're talking about here is there's also the old one of standing behind people so that...
Yeah, I find standing behind creates that I'm different from you perspective, so I probably prefer just a slightly different position in the line.
The next tip is really just something you should do. Need Lego? Of course you do. Yeah, so get on and get some. However, when you buy the Lego on eBay, because it's cheap, however, when you buy that Lego, put it in a delicates bag and put it in the top shelf of the dishwasher. Yeah, but not the rubber wheels.
Okay.
Apparently it might be, you know, have kids.
I've never done any of that before. Okay. I do have Lego though.
It suggests, so if you're like me and you've used tape or something on a board, the worst thing is that, and I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm short, I start at one end and I get to the other end of the wall and it kind of is in some sort of, you know, incline of about, you know, 10 degrees from where I started to where I ended. Which is very annoying because I have to pull it up and all the rest of it. So what they suggest is that you use a thing called gridding tape. Have you used gridding tape before?
No, I've never needed gridding tape. What is gridding tape?
It's meant to work in a grid, so it's actually meant to cross over each other and, you know, get you straight lines and stuff, apparently.
Okay, but I need to talk about this. So, because I spent time coaching Scrum Masters on how to do this, to get a straight vertical line, right? So you put the tape there, then you actually release the tape out, but don't cut the tape off, and you let it dangle there. Then you cut it and let it sort of loosely dangle, then you actually can apply it in a straight line going from there. Then to actually get the distances right, so you should always map out your walls according to the size of your cards. And you should always map them out so that they're limiting work in progress as well. So as much as possible, try and keep it to one card width and a certain length going down the wall.
So yeah, don't give them a card and a half because they will try and shove two cards in there.
Yeah. So just giving a bit of space and just using the card, you put a card at the top of the line that you first created and a card at the bottom, and then you can just create a next straight line just from that because you actually know it's parallel to those cards. It's
like you could have written this blog post, Renee. Yeah. If you often get the urge for visualization on the go, they suggest you should turn your laptop into a portable whiteboard. Apparently you can get whiteboard paint for the front of your laptop.
Yes, okay. I know a lot of people that just use contact paper rather than whiteboard.
And by contact paper, you mean the stuff you cover your school books in?
Yeah, the old school school book thing. Yep.
Yeah, we're all showing your age. Don't they all do it on iPads now?
What's an iPad?
This one I've actually used before. If you're short on whiteboard space or work somewhere with strict rules around putting anything on the walls, then use the magic whiteboard stuff, which is that static paper. That's pretty awesome. It is super duper expensive though.
Or just butcher's paper.
Yeah, although if you can't put blue tack or tape on the walls.
Ah, rules are for pussies.
Okay, I think we found the name of our show now. if you need a place to store stationery on the wall, they suggest use a shower caddy because they have the suction caps and stuff. I know you've used those in your workplaces as well.
Or if you're really cheap like me, use an envelope.
Yes.
With blue tack on it.
Something that has your stuff nearby, because it'll never be there or never be close enough when you need it. If you need to stick team avatars on your board, but it's not magnetic, then get a hot glue gun and some mini suction caps. And suggesting actually using the Lego characters for your avatars.
Or you put blue tack on them.
Well, you could do that too. But most of the world doesn't actually have blue tack. That's more of an Australian thing. Suction caps are pretty cool,
though. It's called OOTAC in the States.
It is, but...
It's white. It's not blue.
But I just don't see people there using it. It's always tape.
It's because they don't know what it is.
There you go. If in doubt, draw it out. So if your team is having, is talking around, then encourage them to draw things on a whiteboard. When you do dot voting, Renee, how do you determine...
The number of dots? The
number of dots and how many votes.
So the number of dots I would allocate would be dependent upon A, the number of post-it notes up there, and B, the number of people in the room. Generally, 2 or 3, depends on the situation. It really depends how happy I'm feeling at the time too, how generous I'm feeling.
I'm seeing a trend here. they suggest here the golden rule is 20% of the number of posts they're voting on.
Well, there you go.
But there you go.
But I think it's also dependent on the number of people. Because if you've got a lot of people, you don't want a lot of dots. You actually want to probably limit to 1 or 2 in that case.
If you need a slightly more permanent space to hang stuff, but you can't damage the wall, they suggest using this thing called gripping stuff, which holds paper and card, etc. on the wall. So essentially it's like a sticky note thing on, like flypaper. You know, sticky stuff on both sides. So that's their suggestion. And they suggest that if you're... tired of killing the forest, or you want to or you don't want things on the walls, then magnetize and reuse your cards by covering them in some sort of plastic film and putting little Velcro strips or magnetic strips on the back,
or use magnetic post-it notes.
Magnetic post-it notes indeed.
So I think useful. I pass your test.
Maybe I might hire you as a scrum master, we'll see.
Awesome. All right, so going into something different, I'm not quite sure how I want to kick this one off. There's probably 2 or 3 things that I want to sort of co-jointly talk together about.
Co-jointly.
It's late. Anyway, so one of them was a couple of Twitter conversations,
actually. Do you realise just how much stuff we get through when Tony isn't here? I'm just realising this. Okay. Hi, Tony, if you're listening.
Hi, Tony. All right, so one was a quote from Dan North. So Dan, our favourite on the podcast. Hey, Dan. And he was saying, safe doesn't require your management to change. In fact, he wasn't saying it. At J Boogie, who's Jeff Goff. I'm going to say it wrong.
Gothelf.
Thank you.
Yep. Where's anyway, Jeff Patton?
So it was this was a quote said by Jeff at Craft Conf.
One of the better agile conferences in the world, so I hear.
Thank you. Safe doesn't require your management to change in any meaningful way. And then there was a little bit of an interesting back and forth that occurred on the Twitter first associated with it. So Jeff sort of said, to clarify, this is not a good thing, but exactly why it's being brought in so much, nothing agile about it. And Martin Burns replied, strange then, about a good third of Safe class for leaders is explicitly about how management will change in very fundamental ways, which is you'd expect anyone who's learnt anything about Safe to call that out. So I think it's an appropriate call out. And Jeff sort of contextualised Dan's comment a little bit further. And I think he actually did a really great job at contextualising his response. So he said, let me clarify again. And he talked about the 140 character limit. So it goes over a few number of tweets. Because there's a class in for Safe for Execs doesn't mean that A, they're attending, B, that they're taking away anything more meaningful than a new vocabulary, and C, that they're truly understanding agility. Most of the execs, real execs, not middle managers, that Jeff works with, can talk safe but don't recognise the implied changes required in the way that they lead, manage for the benefits of it, or any other flavour of agile lean to make an impact. They understand it to be a team-level change. The demands that they're making on their teams haven't changed, neither have the incentive structures. Which I actually thought was a nice,
calling it accurate... It
statement associated.
Yeah, is that you work with a lot of or work around a lot of Safe teams? Would you suggest in recent organisations you've seen this in place? Would you suggest that's an accurate representation?
I think it's certainly an accurate risk that can occur as you implement Safe.
I'd say this is something in a number of organisations that I'm seeing safe in right now, that is 120% accurate.
And I don't think... I think what the call-out is here is that is it an issue of safe or is it an issue with how coaches are potentially implementing safe? I think that's the interesting question.
Depends on where the coaches are coaching. Because if the coaches are coaching at a team level, they're coaching the release train team or the team that's delivering whatever they call it, and safe now. Just mixing my scaling metaphors, but the team that's delivering to that cadence and whatever, then they probably actually don't have a lot of sway over that executive or leadership team.
What I think is missing, I wouldn't say that this is a call out to safe in particular. I'd say this is missing as a community across all of our scaling methods, across all of our approaches, when we have done agile traditionally, we don't give execs a new job. We don't give them really crisp clarity in a meaningful way about what changes in their job on a day-to-day basis. And I know that's certainly something in the current organisation I'm in right now that we're actually trying to address, trying to give that crisp clarity. And I know that it doesn't exist very well because we've had to make a lot of it up in order to really shift the dial in that mindset. Is we actually want to move them out of their day-to-day behaviours. And what change does that particular cause? So I think, in some respects, it's a fair cop-out. I think the responses from the community are fair as well, that they do feel like there's an adequate amount of content there.
I think the difference is knowing the roles you've had in recent years in organisations, though, you are coaching at a different level. Right? You are truly enterprise coaching. And I'm working with some enterprise coaches now that we're in that same boat, where... you have the ear of those people, and part of your mandate is to, is to bring those executive levels along for the journey. How I read that particular tweet storm is the frustration that a lot of people have that they turn up to safe training, sponsored by leaders to go along to it because they want to see some outcomes. They go off, they do their first 3 months of tour of duty, they get to the end and someone at the end goes, not good enough guys, right? I thought I was going to get a bit more, right? That showcase was a little boring, right? I get that one all the time. People want more pizzazz in their showcases.
Oh really?
I've heard that a lot.
Wow.
Recently.
Wow.
They have their end of release. It's not a retrospective, what do they call it in safety, the other thing?
Inspect and adapt?
Yeah, that thing. Mm-hmm. Come to the end, the managers turn up and listen to the things that worked well and didn't work well, but when they try to come up with the actions, they all but disappear. Because, right? They don't want to sit down and talk about that stuff. They just, hear about stuff that's not going so well. And
yeah, it's because that's all the hard stuff, right? So in changing the system, changing the enterprise to remove all the things that are slowing teams down, that's the thing that's actually stopping us from being agile.
Yeah, I mean, those inspect and adapts and retrospectives and the actions, good agile teams can make changes within there, but if you can't escalate those or see the similarities that lots of teams are having and be in a position to try and change those things. When I think about every successful organisation I've worked in, or at least successful team, where there's been a leader who has essentially gone into bat and into fight mode for their team, that's when they have true success. When the team has said, you guys need to sort that out, but they can't requisition a cloud server, or they can't get the resources that they need to get something done, then. It's like everything we say, if you can't actually get actions out of your out of those items, then it's kind of almost for nothing.
Get change, more importantly. Yeah. So you've obviously got actions, but get those actions fulfilled. So for those who listen overseas, we have a term in Australia that talks about that particular problem. We actually call it boomeranging. So when something goes up and then comes back flying and whacks you in the face back down again, that's a boomerang of a retrospective action.
Yeah, so what you're saying is most leaders don't know how to throw a boomerang.
I'm saying most leaders let the boomerang fly past them and it circles all the way back to the person who had the issue and nothing ever happens. What was interesting about this sort of the the level of tweets that came back was an interesting question around whether someone like Don Ryerson endorsed SAFE. Because there's so many of Don's.
I've just got this vision of going to the website and Don's smiling face and says, now endorsed by Don.
And so Dan asked, Dan North asked Don the question, do you endorse SAFE? And I think it was actually a very interesting reply. So Don's reply was, I have roots in analog design, so endorsement is a bit too binary for me, as you would expect from Don. Software folks are more prone to be like 100 or 0% of the methodology. So he's talking about the black or white nature of our community. So he goes on to say, in my opinion, it's a valuable implementation of my ideas. Helpful to the wise, for fools, not so much. Which I thought was a lovely little quote.
Which is essentially whenever you talk to him, and go listen to our podcast with Don that Tony and I did. A few episodes back, in that, you know, you go back and read his book, and it's really based on simplicity. It's based on those really simple things, right? Just get your crap in order, basically, right? You know, optimize your flow, do the stuff that's most valuable first. Don't try to do too many things at once. It's all very simple.
So there was also a similar sort of resurgence of a previous held idea. So in March 2014, there was a blog post that was done from Dave Snowden on the thought leader for Kinevan, where he talked about his feelings on SAFE. And inside the blog post, he's quite blunt, as Dave has a tendency to be. He feels so some of the comments that he made is, to put brutally, SAFE seems to be a prince too camouflaged in agile language. Scrum as an approach was emasculated in a small box at the bottom right of a hugely overcomplicated linear model. And he talks about it in relationship to complexity, which you'd expect. And I think ultimately the crux of his point is that SAFE goes too far to simplify something that is quite complex.
So is he suggesting that SAFE sits in the complex domain but shouldn't?
I'm not going to... I think... Yeah, well, I think he's saying that it tries to push the level of complexity too far to the right, in essence. In reality, it probably doesn't need or can't actually move that far.
Because if you're on the right-hand side of the Kinevan framework...
Yeah.
Then you're going to get away with, simple Kanban, simple Scrum, small stuff. But when you actually move into the complex phase, that's when things do get complex and things can't be structured. And so then putting something that appears structured like SAFE on the top of it, I think a lot of people put faith in the fact that I put SAFE in, then everything's going to be fine. And the reality is it was already complex in the first place. SAFE done correctly... Sure, it's going to help you. But the problem is that the problem gets so complex that then, we start to invent, SAFE butt.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a result, then you're not doing anything correctly and the thing's still complex.
So the original blog post was called SAFE, the infantilism of management. There's been a huge number of comments, especially recently. There's been a resurgence of the comments. In fairness, I don't have enough grasp of the English language to actually read all of the comments. There's an awful lot of big words in there, Dave.
One of them was just in that title that you couldn't pronounce.
I'm a simple person. It's really just me. But I bring these two up, so both Dave's and the Twitter debate around SAFE, because I've been reading the book The Originals, which was recommended to me by Phil Abernathy. Thanks, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
By the way, great book, highly recommend it. Still only halfway through.
Originals by Adam Grant.
Adam Grant, yes.
Published by Penguin.
And the intent behind it is how nonconformists move the world. So it's about people with original thinking. It's about creative thinking and where that lies. I'm getting a lot of nice, interesting parallels to innovation in Agile, the relationships of creativity in collaboration and how to better enact more creative thinking. But the one sort of the point that I want to highlight that's related to these two is it talks about the narcissism of small differences. So I'm going to read you a quote from the book. So this is talking about, according to Dartmouth psychologist Judith White, a lens for understanding these fractures is the concept of horizontal hostility. Even though they share a fundamental objective, radical groups often disparage more mainstream groups as imposters and sellouts. So it goes on to say, White noticed horizontal hostility everywhere. When a deaf woman won the Miss America crown, instead of cheering her on as a trailblazer, deaf activists protested. Since she spoke orally rather than used sign language, she wasn't deaf enough. When a light-skinned black woman was appointed as a law professor at one university, its Black Students Associated objected on the grounds that she wasn't black enough. And it goes through all these various examples, including vegans and vegetarians and so forth. My point is, we continue to be a community of agileists that attack each other.
And you just have to go through the lists of episodes where we've talked about such things in the past. You know, go back to some of our early episodes where we talked about the Scrum versus Kanban.
Yep. And I'm not saying, in fairness, that you and me as well, Craig, are not guilty of this.
I'm just saying that across the 5 years we've been doing this podcast, almost, this has been a theme that has come up in podcasts all the way through, starting back at that level and for a whole bunch of other things that come up in the community.
And so I read this particular chapter. It's talking about Goldilocks being, you know, not too heavy, not too light, just right. It's about getting change, the right level of change that could be potentially adopted. We create extremist groups inside of Agile because we don't agree with each other. And so we consider certain groups more extreme than others. So you look at the No Estimates movement, for example, where lots of people have considered that quite an extreme movement. And you've got the people who are trying to probably conform more to reality, so SAFe being probably a good example of that. And the extremists look at SAFe and go, you're not helping our cause. In reality, we're not helping all of our cause. And I've read this chapter and I just felt absolutely dismayed at what we were doing in fighting with each other when the real problem is not us. We've got so much change that we need to get through. We should be trying to band together more than we are.
And that concludes the Agile Revolution. And so what do we do, though? Right? So
it's interesting because I think it's a personal change that's potentially required. I know, for example, I could think of someone who I would consider a friend recently went out with some thought leadership on a particular piece of work. And I know reading this book, I deliberately tempered some of my more extreme reactions to some of the things because it didn't matter.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, and, I'll put my hat on as being a board member of the Agile Alliance for a moment. Right? The Agile Alliance, there's lots of people who, look at that organisation and have a lot of criticisms and in a lot of cases probably for some reasonable reason. The one thing that organisation, one of the reasons why I agreed to join that board was that they are there for the big tent of agility.
Mm.
Everything sits under there. And so, for example, when our friends of Scrum Study came along and wanted to be part of the big Agile conference, the big tent says is that we may not necessarily agree with everything you talk about, but let's bring the stage. I know more recently in this country, being on the program committee of one of our large Agile conferences, when there was a lot of discussion about bringing out Dean Leffingwell to talk on SAFe. And there was a lot of people who were very advocate going, we don't want to put that person on the stage. My view was whether you like it or don't like it,
it moves us forward.
Yeah, and I want to hear it from, the horse's mouth, so to speak. Yeah. I'm suggesting that Dean's a horse. But I want to hear it from the inventor. Like if I want to hear it from somebody, I want to hear that because yes, we all have voices and there are things in everything. Like I've openly said on this podcast, for example, I don't want to pick on SAFe, but it's just the one we've been talking about, is that the portfolio level in SAFe is some of the best stuff written on portfolios out there.
Mm, I agree.
In one place.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree about some of the stuff in the middle there, but I understand why they've done it.
Yeah.
And for some organisations, that is the right approach. Absolute right approach. For me, it's never the ending approach, but nothing in agility is the end. Right? Scrum is not the end. SAFe is not the end. Extreme programming is not the end. there are places to start, and as more problems and more, you know, situations come up that we need to resolve and fix, then we'll find different things to go and resolve and fix those.
Yeah, so I guess to your question earlier, what's the call to action? I think one would be, if you find yourself being more of an extremist in response to some of these things, you know, think about working from within rather than from without. You know, that whole improv concept of yes and. So going with it and then looking at how you can work with them to incrementally change it rather than work against it.
And I think the interesting thing is, and scaling has been probably one of the more recent ones of this, is that there's a reason why multiple scaling frameworks have popped up.
Because it's a complex problem.
It's a complex problem. Yeah. None of them are the answer right now. They all have positive and, I don't want to say negative, that's not the right word, but, you know,
pros and cons
or different advantages, right, depending on which one that you would...
situation that you're in,
you would go and choose. And so, you know, we often talk about our friend Alistair, and so since Tony's not here, I'll channel him. I always come back to the Oath of Non-Allegiance of Alistair Coburn, which I still don't think is a well-known enough approach, which is, you know, I'll consider, you know, things from all schools of thought.
Yeah, well, I sort of think the alternate version is have a really broad toolkit, use the appropriate tool for the particular problem that you're trying to have, rather than think about there's just one framework that's going to solve all of your particular problems. But I think that the interesting tie back to it, this is our infighting as a community probably helps to create those perceptions that we talked about earlier at that C-suite of, you know, those people that discredit it or that it's an IT fad as well.
Well, if you're on the outside and never done this before, and we talked about this on previous podcasts before, where the heck do you go to start?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things we get often asked for, you know, on our first day or working with a new team or a new organisation. Right, where do I start? And the answer is, I don't know, right? Because it depends on the problem. It's a hard question to ask, and I'm glad someone hasn't written Agile, the Definitive Guide.
I thought you were going to say Agile Body of Knowledge there.
No. You have it on your bookshelf over there, I noticed.
That's a Scrum Body of Knowledge, in fairness.
That's true. I've got my glasses on, I can't read a thing. But that's a good reason why, right? And that book, even if you did write it, if you could write it, it would never be finished. Because what's been good about our community is that over the years we have found, you know, more new and updated techniques to solve the problems that we've had. Some have stood the test of time and some have completely disappeared.
Yeah, and I think that the reality is there'll always be more problems that we need to solve, so we'll always be discovering new ways of working.
Yeah, well, it's the old adage, right? It's that we move something to the left, and that's going to, you know, push something else out of alignment. And so, once we sort something and get it sorted over here, so, you know, the problems that we have solved in the last 15 years, right? The things that we don't really have any excuses on, is fundamental software engineering. If you actually look at the core practices of writing code, putting it somewhere, you know, moving it to another environment somewhere, right? Helped by technology, things like the cloud and mobile and those type of things, there's not a lot of excuses for that, right? Yet how many organizations that want to go down the agile path and haven't really thought about, you know, simple things like continuous integration or continuous delivery?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you have to deploy something every, you know, 16 seconds to production, because that doesn't make sense for some organizations. But the reality is that you take all those pain points out and then focus your attention on the things that matter, right? Focus on users, focus on, you know, the real problems, rather than living with all the problems of the past. We sorted that problem. Right. As technology gets better, we're going to continue to sort those in the background. The things that we now need to go and sort are all the other things around the outside. It's really the people issues. It's the linking into other parts of the organisation that don't think in technical terms. That's where our real challenges are as an Agile committee, in my opinion.
That's it for me. What else for you?
So, sort of related to that is a recent article on InfoQ called "Culture May Eat Agile for Breakfast." You know, which is really talking about the same things we've been talking about, particularly as organisations. You know, the question they sort of ask is, can an organisation double in size annually and stay or become agile at the same time? Which is really the problem. You know, we were just talking you know, before this podcast about a couple of organisations we know that are going down the agile path, and in both cases, you know, they're looking for people to help them with their agile transformation and expecting the organisation to grow because, you know, they're trying to bring in digital you know, approaches and things. So, can an organisation double in size and become agile at the same time, Renee?
I believe so, yes.
So the things they talk about here is that...
it's not going to be easy, but yes.
You know, really, you know, agility, again, this is my time, you know, tested, rolled out, you know, statement, but, you know, agile is the vehicle, not the destination. And the fact is that, you know, your organisation culture is always going to, you know, be evolving and amending. If you do not, what they say there is, if you don't actively shape your culture, right, then something will emerge, right? If you don't actually have your eye on that and make sure the bad things aren't, you know, taken care of. Yep. We've seen that before, right? So, you know, their point is that there's no organisation without a culture.
Does it give any practical tips as to how to do that?
It does through the article. It's quite a lengthy article on the way through.
Can you give us an example?
They've got a section here about you know, how to fend off invasive cultures and stay agile. So a couple of things they talk about is, for example, if short-term thinking pushes the organisation to hire new staff, why not add some management layers at the same time? And they give the example of organisations in hiring, like Zappos, and their where they would approach candidates after a week, and where they prefer to take $3,000 as opposed to staying on, or Menlo Innovations. When they people are coming for trials, they say they'll bring people in for an interview and they'll speed date them with the staff to make sure that they fit with the culture.
So recruit for culture is basically what you're saying there. Yep.
And elevating the HR department into a servant leadership role, so that their focus is on building a great organisation by hiring the best candidates as opposed to just, you know, the first person that comes along with skill.
They talk about mitosis there.
Not that I recall.
Ah, so I guess that will be my next blog post. I've got a Scaling Agile series, a tip that I've got around keeping culture is, as you scale, is the mitosis tip, where you, it's a really simple pattern, basically. So if you know that you're going to scale, sort of grow your teams to an unfortunately slightly normal, then larger size than is normally accepted, and then break it into two so that culture is distilled throughout, and then grow those two teams up to that next level, and sort of can end up effectively like cell division, splitting teams until you have a certain number. And I've certainly used that in the past, where I've gone from four teams to 15 teams in the space of around about 6 months.
The key to that, though, is that the teams need to be completely self-autonomous.
Yeah, of course.
And that's where a lot of people go wrong with that.
Yeah.
Is that you're still relying on a whole bunch of people over in another cell over here that are working in a completely different way, and so then as a result, the whole thing slows down.
Yeah.
So essentially, you build a new organisation.
Yes, exactly.
And then just keep building small little organisations.
Yes.
And it's a bit like a merger of two startups. You bring them back together, but because they've come from a very similar cell,
yeah,
that bringing them back together is,
yep,
reasonably straightforward. There are other tips. Resist the urge to hire merely for skills, because obviously they won't match your culture. Your existing agile culture can be easily overwhelmed by the influx of new culture fragments, because lots of people have come from lots of places. And we did it this way here, or that's not the way we did agile on my last team. Don't incentivize HR to fill open positions as soon as possible, which often is a case.
That's a good one,
you know,
that one.
Because we've got all these open positions, and if I don't get them filled, then...
You want to hire for the right person if that takes you...
And ruthlessly educate all new hires and remove misfits with a non-agile mindset early in the process, which were the examples that I gave you before.
Nice.
So it's a good little article on InfoQ. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Who's it by?
Stefan Wolpers, based out of Berlin, Germany. Thank you, Steph.
Cool. So I don't know what time we're at. Anything of note? Are you reading anything interesting?
I have just started, and I'm going to have to find the name of the book to get it right, but it's about, I've been playing around with using Lego more in training and retrospectives, just to get away from so many places I go into and they're doing the same thing. So I do a lot more when I come in as a coach of getting people to move around. So I use a lot of constellation type activities, but using Lego as a approach. And so there's a great new book, which I'll have to bring up on here. I can't even find the button I want to press here. But it's about using Lego more effectively in your organization. I'll find the author in just a moment.
Is it similar concept to Lego Serious Play?
Yeah, it's not exactly it's not Lego Serious Play per se, but it's got the same type of ideas as Lego Serious Play. And and looking at my Kindle and I can't see the book. There you go. That would teach me to be prepared, wouldn't it? Let's try one of the other book readers I have on my iPad here.
Well, whilst you're talking, I'll talk about what I've been reading. Obviously, I'm still in part way reading through the originals at the moment, so hopefully by the time we do our next podcast together, I can sort of wrap up the second half of that book. I have a whip issue on books at the moment, so I'm also partway through Immunity to Change, which I'm really liking. So if you're a coach in an organisation, I'd highly recommend Immunity to Change, as it deals with the root cause of why people are not changing to a more agile way of working. That's not an agile book, to be clear. It's a change book. And aside from those two books, I'm really happy to say in the last week I have managed to pass my Holacracy Practitioner Certification.
High five.
Yeah. Which was a real challenge to get.
So tell us a little bit about, just before we finish this section, so the book is called Lego for Scrum, the third complete edition, by Alexei Krivitsky, with a foreword by Henrik Nyberg, and talks about how to do a whole bunch of things like story mapping and estimates and backlog refinement and all those kind of things, all synced up with Lego bricks. So it's a learning book. So I've only just worked on it. It's a very short book, available on EPUB. We'll put a link in the show notes. So tell us a little bit. So you went and sat, since we've last spoken, you went and sat the Holacracy
practitioner course. A 5-day course.
With the god of Holacracy.
Yes, Brian Robertson.
And tell us about it.
It was a great course. It was held in Philadelphia, so I won't hold back the long trip against the course. But
Lick the Liberty Bell?
I didn't lick the Liberty Bell. There was a security guard right next to it, but I did visit the Liberty Bell right when Trump was busy trying to get immigrants out of his country at the same time. Aside from that, I guess what was interesting
are the comments of Renee, not necessarily the edge of revolution.
The takeouts were, I was really surprised by the number of people who were attending who actually were in Holacracy running organisations. I'd say it was around about 75% of people, and I was the rare person that actually wasn't in an organisation that was trying to do Holacracy.
Kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and I think I got as much valuable insight out of the people as I got through the training. Now, Brian is just an amazingly awesome trainer, as succinct and eloquent as he is in speaking, in like the Google video, for example, about Holacracy, he is equally that in a training room. So it was very inspiring just to see a really great trainer in practice. And what was interesting is they had, I think, about four coaches there as well. So not only just Brian, four coaches in order to go through the simulation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Simulation was quite complicated. There were some bits that I didn't like about it because it wasn't prefaced, because it's a simulation. I sort of more treated it as a game than a simulation. And in that context, I wanted to win because that's the competitive nature inside of me. And once I'd gotten over the fact that I can't win, and that it just was a learning simulation, I was a lot happier with it. I got an awful lot out of the course. Basically, there's so many tips and tricks that you wouldn't pick up through the book or through the Constitution. I got to admit, the Constitution is quite dry to read, but the actual simulations really bring it to life and what it actually feels like to be able to facilitate both the governance and the tactical meeting. So for those of you who don't familiar, because we haven't really talked about it, Holacracy being what's considered a Frederick Lew Teal-based approach, being an approach towards managing an organisation without necessarily having managers in an organisation.
And we probably haven't really talked about Frederick Laloux's book either. So
I think we have a few times talked about Frederick Laloux's book, which is why I use that. But if you haven't, Reinventing Organisations, other than Immunity to Change, probably a top tier book to also read as an agile coach.
Yeah, definitely go and read that, and Holacracy if you're after some tips. Was there like a key takeaway for you?
Yeah, there was a couple of key takeaways. So I think that ideology of tensions being micro-tensions and processing micro-tensions one at a time. So probably the big deal was in the job that I currently have as an enterprise agile coach, I spent almost all of my time consensus building. And what Holacracy does is it gives you absolute clarity around accountabilities so that you don't have to do consensus building anymore. So it was like this huge moment of, oh my goodness, there's literally like 5-10% of the organization is permanently trying to consensus build, that you would just take that cost away immediately by implementing holacracy. I think that ideology of processing tensions one by one, and me not adding my tension onto your tension, for example, Craig, so that you only just dealt with my needs at that particular point in time. And some of the statistics around the fact that if you had a tension and I had wanted to bang on and add my little bandwagon against it, you know, very little percentages of times do people actually add their bit onto it if they were forced to process it differently. Mm. So I think we spend a lot of time over engineering solutions is probably the second takeaway that I got out of that.
So can it work?
I don't know. I didn't really feel... I think it's a really fair call.
It feels like a lot of common sense.
It's extremely disciplined and extremely rigid of a process.
Let me replay that. The outcome of it seems common sense, that about why you would do it, the actual implementation of it...
It's not.
What I mean, though, is that when you look at it and you read it, you almost sit there and go,
And I think that probably is the thing. Is like I read the book and I've listened to people talk about it, but I really didn't understand it till I went on the course.
Okay, interesting.
I think as far as whether it's going to work or not, really too early to tell. Like if you talk about it being the next step past agility, look at where we're at with agile right now. We still even don't know the answer to that. So I think we've got many decades before we know whether holacracy is going to work. And I'm sure as they have already over the last decade continued to evolve it, they will continue to evolve it as well. I know that there's complaints around things like the lack of humanity inside of some of the process. And I'm pretty sure that that will be something that they might end up addressing going forward.
Hmm, interesting. And I guess what we're talking about, things that we've attended and certifications, I also went over to the US in the last few months and did the Agility Health Facilitator certification, which is tooling around doing agile health assessments for teams. So Agility Health is a tool. That was a really interesting couple of courses. I mean, obviously, a lot of it was tool related about how to use the tool. But what I was really impressed about was the effort that the builders of that tool have actually put into, I guess, some of the questioning. But more importantly, what I hadn't really realized in there was the real importance they put on making sure you can manage those, treat as a retrospective and manage those things up across the organization. And again, a bit like you, I was probably the odd man out in the room there, or the odd person out in the room, of being probably the only person who hadn't actually currently using that tool. All the people that were going there were organizations already invested in this. And
but what's the reason why you haven't used the tool? Is it because I know in organizations that we've both worked together in the past, we've actually built our own tool. Whether you call it a health rater or a capability pulse check or a maturity assessment, they're all sort of the same thing. So how does it compare against ones that you've built yourself in the past and you've used yourself in the past?
Yeah, great question. I feel the there's been a lot of time on the anonymity of the tool. So you have to try really hard or do something really dopey to be able to figure out who actually answers questions to what. And it does bring out, because the way they ask the questions and the way that they prepare the results does really bring out, richer than anyone I've built before, the reporting to say, yeah, you know what, we've actually got a lot of variance at this particular level. Some people think our backlogs are really awesome and some people think our backlogs are really garbage. And what you can do, if you so wish, is that you can then drill down and say, you know, most people who have the role of business analyst think they're very good, and most people who have the role of developer think that they're actually not so good.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And that's all in how you set it up.
Right.
Actually set the tool up. But it's engineered in a way that you can be very flexible with it. But as I said, it's also engineered to ensure that you can continue to track your results over time, but more importantly also start to see trends across the organization so that more senior leadership can deal with them.
And is it something that they're, as an organisation, of maintaining it open to feedback as well?
Yeah, so they've got pretty extensive documentation and learning opportunities in the tool, so they're constantly updating it. I think since I've done the course, I've probably had six or seven releases of the tool, and that was only a few months ago.
Wow.
So constantly updating it based on feedback from what I can tell.
Okay.
So I got just as much out of it from whether I ever use the tool or not, just from sitting the course, just on thinking about how to... because I was just thinking about how would I actually assess the maturity, and then the added bonus was that I just learned some of the tips and tricks about how the tool worked, but the actual certification itself was more about facilitation of agility,
getting
health.
The outcome. Yeah, great.
I think we're just about done, and your dog mm-hmm. is looking at you as if he wants to go for a walk.
Yes, my incontinent dog is looking for an escape outside.
And probably most of our listeners are too. This has gone on for a long time. So
if anyone wants to contact me, you can contact me on Twitter at AgileRenee, or you can contact me, Renee, at theagilerevolution.com.
Yeah, and I'm my Twitter handle is really hard, SmithCDAU, because there's so many Craig Smiths in the world. And you can get me at Craig@theagilerevolution.com.
I'm more than happy to take any sort of feedback, or if you want us to answer particular questions or talk about a topic.
About time we had another mailbag.
Yes, we would really appreciate your thoughts about what we could talk about rather than us just rambling on about stuff that we care about.
Absolutely.
And I think that's it for us.
Oh, one last thing to say, isn't it?
Yep. And viva la revolution.